The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program and thank you for joining us. When we hear about Series A funding rounds, we usually hear about massive investments in the millions of dollars from a small number of investors. And almost always, institutional capital is heavily involved, but that's not always the case, especially in the cannabis space. Vertical, the largest, at least they claim to be the largest vertically integrated cannabis company, recently closed a Series A round at $58 million. And not only was this the largest ever, again, this is their claim, not mine, Series A raise for a seed-to-sale cannabis company. It was also composed significantly of smaller investments, as low as $25,000 for many high net worth individuals. Most of the investments were only around $100,000. Now, the driving force of this unorthodox and really highly, what appears to be a highly successful funding style was Vertical President Smoke Wallen, who's going to be joining us shortly. And that is correct, Smoke Wallen, S-M-O-K-E. When I talked to him a couple weeks ago, I told him, you sound like a character in a Kinky Friedman novel. And I was sincere about that. I meant that as a compliment. And I asked him what his real name is, because I'm figuring this, how could it be that guys in the cannabis business and his first name is literally Smoke? But he indeed said his parents named him Smoke. So Smoke Wallen, was constantly on the road for 15 months raising this money, tirelessly calling investors and setting up meetings, in order to earn the multitude of smaller investments that would end up comprising Vertical's landmark funding round. In fact, Smoke had obtained so much demand from investors that Vertical ended up upsizing the original Series A from $20 million to $35 million, and it ended up being oversubscribed by $23 million. As I said earlier, a total of $58 million. Now, what Smoke Wallen is going to do when he joins us is he's going to explain this unique and grueling process that he went through. This basically a roadshow, which we associate with IPOs, where companies will go on the road and meet with analysts and investment banks and so on and talk about why people should be buying their stock. Obviously, this is still a private company, but he did go on that style of roadshow. Calls himself a road warrior, or at least took a road warrior approach to fundraising, and is going to talk to us about how it can transform the way that businesses approach their funding rounds. He is also going to explain how his methods mirror the current trend of political campaigns to rely on smaller contributors for a wider pool of supporters, which I find very interesting, especially in the heat of the political season we're seeing right now with the presidential campaign about to kick off. Already the Democratic nominees are vying for the nomination for president. And that has changed a lot with social media and this approach to many smaller investors rather than fewer very large investors. So this is going to be an interesting discussion. I'm glad you joined us. Bear with me as we wait for Smoke to call in. He will be joining us very shortly, but we'll ask him, you know, what kind of investors he drew in to funding a cannabis campaign, what his pitch was, what he's going to do with the money that he's raised. I'm also curious about the level of enthusiasm among cannabis investors vis-a-vis investors of other asset classes. We'll see if he thinks there's a difference there. And what lessons he learned that he can pass along to other entrepreneurs or fundraisers, particularly cannabis entrepreneurs. We will know the answers to those questions shortly. Okay, Smoke, how you doing?
All right. I'm well. How can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you loud and clear. Fantastic.
All right, good deal.
So listen, I was just introducing you to our listeners. Gave some background on you, including that Smoke is a real name. It's not a. Although I did notice on your bio, there's a J in front of it. So, what does that stand for? J or John or James or?
My first name is John, and middle name Smoke, and on my birth certificate. So mom knew, I guess, 5 decades ago that her baby would be in this business, I guess.
There's something to be said about a woman's intuition, especially a mother's intuition. So all good. She made a very wise choice there. And we'll give you your father credit for going along with it.
Exactly.
You know, you're in an interesting business. It's a hot business. I've already told our audience some of the areas that we'll be talking about. Let me ask you first, though, have you done a fundraise before, or is this the first time you've gone out and raised money?
I've raised probably around close to $500 million over the years for different businesses that I've started or been involved with.
So this campaign sounds like it was different than the others, that you took a different approach. Did you do a roadshow with those other campaigns, or what differentiated this one from the others? Was this, obviously, this was a very long and persistent campaign, it sounds like. I think it went 15 months?
Yeah, actually, it was a bit shorter than that, but it certainly started last summer, and we closed out. And so I would say it was more like a 9-month process by the time we finished it up. But yeah, I mean, I think the big difference is, first of all, this is a very, as you know, exciting category and lots of interest. And because of the unique nature of the cannabis space, where there's a federal prohibition but a state legal system where we operate, there's a big separation between those that can invest or felt comfortable investing in this space versus those who, for whatever reason, are prohibited. And that really drove the nature of the round and also the length of it, because if you were raising $62 million in a private placement, typically that's the kind of size that you would typically get some, more of institutional funds involved than individuals. And in this case, because of the federal prohibition, most of the institutional players have been kept out of the space, and it's all family offices and high net worth individuals, and that really drove the complexion of the round.
So the company is vertical, and you say that it's the largest vertically integrated cannabis CBG company. When you say vertically integrated, I take that to mean you grow it, you process it, you turn it into product, you retail it. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so what do you mean by CPG company? I'm not familiar with that acronym.
So that stands for consumer packaged goods. So we look at ourselves as, if you think about, somewhere in between Nestle, Procter & Gamble, Coca-Cola, Diageo, all right, these are all consumer packaged brand companies, right? Different categories, but they have lots of brands across their portfolio, and that's how we think of ourselves. So we're putting brands together in different form factors that utilize the extracts and the output from the cannabis plant, and those brands are consumer brands. So that's really, when we say CPG, that's really how we think about it. We have a large portfolio of trademarks that we are developing in different forms that meet consumer needs in different need states and instances. And that what I mean by form factors, just to be clear, we're talking about, right, so the traditional cannabis output you would think of maybe from the old days, maybe from your college days, like smokable flower, like a bong or a joint or something like that. And that's 5 years ago, that was 95% of the business. Today, that's down to half the business. And the rest of the form factors represent the rest of the business. And in 5 years, we think the flower itself could be as low as 15% of the total business, not because it shrinks, but because everything else grows. Those other form factors, basically, you extract the oil from the cannabis plant, and you can place it into everything from, you know, vape pens to beverages, yeah. food, edibles, topicals, medicines, right? There's a huge range of applications for the output for the cannabinoids. And when that's what I'm talking about when I talk about form factors and brands within those categories.
You know, and anybody who has walked in a large dispensary is overwhelmed by the amount of product there is. There's so many different types of product. You really need a tour guide if you're not already familiar with it and know what it is that you like and what you're looking for. So you go out and you're looking for $20 million to $35 million. You end up with $58 million. And what's the money going to be used for?
Well, so this was really important and stuff, but one of the important things is this is such a growth business that everybody needs capital, and we're no different. So we're doing a lot of things. You know, you mentioned in the beginning we're vertically integrated, so we've got cultivation, grow, which is the grow side, extraction, manufacturing, and then distribution and brands, and all those things take investment. So what we did is this capital was a rolling close. We were able to use it along the way, so it wasn't like I had to wait 9 months to get all the money. We made it rolling close on purpose because we had many uses for it throughout the year, just operating the business, but also building out our infrastructure. You know, $17.5 million of the money went into buildings that we built out for our campus out of Needles, and some of those investments were made prior and then rolled into this round, and then a lot of the new money that came in, you know, went to building out our outdoor grows, to building out our brands and our distribution side of things. So it's really been infrastructure, and one reason that's been so important, because, you know, I mentioned we look at ourselves as a CPG, a brand company, doing lots of, you know, consumer-focused things, and yet most of my capital has gone into infrastructure, and there's a reason for that. You know, if I wanted to create a new whiskey, I could call 10 people today who I know personally who have distilleries that could make it to my recipe and my specs exactly the way I want it, and it's got a, you know, it's a developed ecosystem, and that's true of most categories. There are entities out there that will co-pack and manage and manufacture products for brands. In this space, there's no infrastructure yet. So it's not like you can go call a bunch of established companies. The whole industry is new. So we felt it was really critical that in order to build brands, we had the ability to make them. And that's why the whole vertical integration piece is so important.
Okay, so let's talk about the investors you corralled. To begin with, let me back up a second. You mentioned Needles. You're referring to Needles, California. That's where your company is based. Is that right?
We're based in Agoura Hills, which is just outside of L.A.
Yeah. Okay.
But our campus, where we do a lot of our indoor grows and manufacturing, is in Needles, California, which is out in the desert in California, but closer to Vegas.
Okay. Now, so with regard to the type of investors you attracted, now these were high net worth individuals, they were families or family offices, not institutional dollars for the reasons you explained. Talk though about, characterize that group. What kind of people, what kind of investors are most interested in funding cannabis? Maybe psychographically or demographically, how would you characterize them other than their, you know, wealthy individuals or families?
Well, I think, you know, anyone who's paying attention recognizes that there's a massive arbitrage between today with federal prohibition and state legal framework, and someday tomorrow, not literally tomorrow, but someday in a not too distant future when there's the federal prohibition is removed. And when that happens, tens of billions of dollars of institutional money, both corporate and institutional investors, will flow into the space. So the type of individuals who are interested in this are people that want outsized returns and are willing to take the risk that the federal prohibition may take longer, so it may take a while, and that, you know, it is a federally not legal products. So that's a risk that some people can't get comfortable with. But if you're looking for growth, which I think many investors are, and if you have a growth profile, you can't find a better industry to invest against if you can get the right team and scaling company.
But the people themselves are, is there an age category? Is there a persuasion politically? Do they tend to be users of?
Interestingly, a lot of them don't tend to be users. And in the families that I know, so look, there's a lot of, when I say families, it's less family offices as it is families that are, successful families in business who, decide to look at the space. So we have, I came out of the beverage alcohol space. I was chairman of the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of America. I've been very involved with that whole world. And what we found is that a lot of our relationships over in the alcohol, beer, spirits distribution space have had a lot of interest in this because they look at it as a parallel segment. Your listeners probably all know about Constellation Brands putting $4 billion into Canopy Growth. Mm-hmm. So that's a big public deal. But I think what we've seen is a lot of the privately held families who have substantial interest in alcohol have had a big interest in investing in the space, if for no other reason, to learn about it, potentially, get good returns, but to understand it and be a part of it as it legalizes. So that's part of the demographic. And within these families, typically it's been the kid, like the next generation, the 20 and 30 and maybe 40-year-olds who are part of a family organization. They see the future, and they've advocated within their families to allow a portion of their portfolios go into this space. So it's definitely has skewed younger. A lot of our friends, outside of alcohol, just who run companies, a lot of CEOs of companies that are just in our networks who, this is not their main investment. They may run a business in a completely different industry, but they have portfolios where they're investing and diversifying, and this was one of the big opportunities. So that's a lot of what we've seen.
Now, you obviously had a successful pitch. So summarize for us what your message was to investors. And this is a dangerous question because the entrepreneurs I've known, you ask them to talk about their business, the pitch, and they could go on and on and on. So I'm trusting you, Smoke, to really put this in a nutshell. In just a couple minutes, summarize that pitch with all of us knowing that there's much more to it than that. But what's the essence of the pitch that was so successful for you out there with investors?
So the proverbial elevator pitch, is that that's what we're talking about?
Exactly.
Okay. So look, number one, we can all agree that this is an extraordinary moment in time in an extraordinarily growing category. Not only do we know there's been a very large cannabis business in the illegal market for generations, but we also know that with new form factors and new applications, the growth is immense, right? And it's very observable, and I don't think you get any argument about that. So if, a few years back, there was a study of, which companies, why were early stage investments, which ones were successful and which ones weren't. And, everybody talks about management team, execution, access to capital, business model, those typical things that all are very important things. But the number one characteristic of successful, big time successful exits in some of these venture funds have been observed, and these were over hundreds of companies, was timing. The timing of when you get in and when that company is doing what it's doing mattered more than anything else. And so what I would put forth is that at this moment in time, there's never been a better time to be in the space. The arbitrage exists between now and when the federal prohibition ends. And if you find the right team who have proven track records and executed in other industries, especially other regulated industries like beverage alcohol that, you know, have a parallel structure, then you put your bet on them and you get behind them. And that's the essence of our pitch. You know, it's also a brand story. It's a vertically integrated story. It's a large supply chain with brands attached to it. But at the end of the day, it's timing, scale, and team.
Mm. You know, you made the observation that when the federal prohibition ends, or the, you know, kind of a prediction, which I think is inevitable, in part because of what somebody said to me, I heard them on a podcast or newscast, and the guy said that marijuana has been legalized in several states and the sky didn't fall and society didn't, civilization did not fall apart. And now we've even had Denver and Oakland legalizing psilocybin. In fact, I think Oakland legalized Mother Nature. So any psychoactive plant, any kind of plant that has any kind of medicinal or psychoactive uses are legal now in the city of Oakland. So even down to the city level, people are starting to realize that we've always been tolerant of these extremely dangerous pharmaceuticals, and yet these naturally occurring substances in nature, we've gotten pretty freaked out about and made them Schedule 1 drugs, I guess it is, that prohibits people. Is that right, Schedule 1 or Schedule A?
Schedule 1, and this is a category, this cannabis in particular, never should have been put on the list. It was always a mistake. And it was led by some special interests and some very racist people that were in control of situation in our government back in the 30s. Yeah. And they just kind of piled on. And we've all been, you know, anyone who's an adult now, you know, who's grown up with, hey, this is your brain on drugs, you know, all the campaigns. And, you know, I'm not an advocate for, you know, widely accessible, you know, drugs in general and recreational use necessarily. You know, this, a lot of what we're doing is about the health and wellness side of it. But that being said, you know, we've been misinformed, and the medical community's been misinformed. And the idea that you have doctors who didn't even know there was a cannabinoid system inside, an endocannabinoid system in our bodies until, you know, not a couple decades ago. And you just think about the missing link there of like medical research, doctors not even knowing that this whole system is in your body, only because somebody arbitrarily in government decided to ban it, so nobody studied it, is pretty bizarre, and it's a little bit crazy when you think about it.
Yeah, well, we're moving past that very quickly, and I should just say psilocybin, as you know, Smoke, but for our listeners who might not be familiar with it, is being used to treat GIs coming back from wars, to treat PTSD. It's being used in therapy. It's been used successfully in psychotherapy, and for many, many years, thousands of years, it's been used in religious ceremonies and so on. So it's not just it's not a party drug. It's being used for very good and very necessary purposes, although obviously it's been used as a party drug by some people, but first and foremost, they want to use it for research, therapy, and spiritual insights and so on.
Yep.
Now, let's get to the fundraising again. So you were on the road continuously for about 9 months. That by its very nature says there's a lot of travel and lodging expenses. So you had to worry about your burn rate, which I realize it's not like a company burn rate, but what did you do? Kind of explain how you kept your roadshow costs in check. Even as you were raising money, you had to be traveling and lodging. So how do you handle that?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a cost to doing this, no matter how you do it. But I think one way we kept it pretty low is my partner Todd and I, you know, did most of the raising, and we didn't have a whole team of people running around. We went out and told the story and met with investors, and we certainly had many come to us and visit us. We did a lot of calls and video chats, but there's nothing quite like being in front of someone and telling them the story, and you know, you have to get out and do it. And I early on in my career, when I had to raise money, I realized that I had to be really accessible. Like if an investor wanted to see me, I had to make it my business to make it easy for them, because they just keep moving on and to the next thing if I didn't. So I typically would just find out when someone's available, and I would make myself available then. And if it's in New York, I would just be there, and I'd try to plan as many meetings around that trip as I could. But you know, it really, you know, you're exactly right. I mean, there's an expense to this. You can't get around that. It obviously goes up a lot if you have a whole team traveling, or if you have a bunch of bankers and other people going with you. But you know, hopefully you build that into your plan and you have enough runway to go do it.
Where did you get your target list? How did you know who to contact to meet with? What was your source for the high net worth investors and families?
Well, so one of the benefits of doing this, not as a so we all would love to be in our 20s or 30s and all the good things that come with that. But the good thing that comes with doing it in your 40s and 50s is that if you've been successful in business, you have a large network. And really, that's it really came from our Rolodex. There, I'm dating myself. I called it Rolodex. But, you know, it came from our contact list, our relationships over many years. And we're in groups, networks like YPO, Young Presidents Organization, and I mentioned the alcohol world. That's a world I spent a long career in, so I know all the families in that. And then it's just networking. It's getting the word out and having people make introductions. And I'm not saying it's easy, but you know, if you've been in business a while and you've had a big network, it's obviously more attainable. It's one of the reasons that a lot of companies go hire somebody or some bank to do it, because they have these lists. And you know, both Todd and I have been successful in past ventures, and we've been able to go to past investors as well as their friends. And and then if you're doing things in your business that are noticeable, word gets out, right? So whether it's on LinkedIn or it's in the press, it certainly has driven attention to what we're doing. In a hyper growth category, you stand out if you can get the word out, and that's certainly benefited us. I've had the good opportunity of being on a number of the big business shows, and Stuart Varney and Fast Money and a bunch of the other ones, and that really came, not talking about our round, but talking about the industry and being out in the speaker circuit. I've spoken at most of the industry conferences. That's obviously been a very high profile thing, and in front of a lot of people looking at the space. So that's generated a lot of investor interest as well.
So your front people said your fundraising effort was similar to a political campaign, which I found really interesting, that you were raising small contributions from many investors. Talk about that. How would you, we see political candidates saying, I won't take any PAC money, I won't take any big contributors. Obviously, you would have taken a big contributor in your case, but they weren't really there, so you had to rely on that. But in what other ways was it like a political campaign? Was that the extent of it, or was there more to it? Because you were out on the road, much like a political candidate's out on the road, shaking hands, kissing babies, and making promises. So what can you say about that?
Yeah, well, and first of all, I don't look at my investors as contributors. I look at them as investors. So just to be clear, they aren't contributing. They're participating. But that being said, I can see the parallel or the analogy. You have to get out in the circuit. It comes back to kind of what I was talking about, speaking at a lot of these industry conferences and having the opportunity to get out in front of audiences and tell the story of the industry first, secondarily what we're doing, right? And if you can have an active voice in what's happening in the industry, that generates interest. And I think that's where kind of the parallel is, right? If you're you're talking about issues and you're out on the trail and you're generating interest, and you get people to back you. And, at the end of the day, people invest in companies, but they really back people and management teams. And you can't replicate that need, right? You've got to get in front of people and they've got to see you in action. And I think that, generates confidence that, hey, this is a group that's going somewhere. These are people I can get behind. I want to get behind and invest them. And that's how it's worked for us. And yeah, I mean, it's not like a Bernie Sanders or whatever, like where everybody's giving $25. I mean, these are, small investments, like $100,000, $200,000 kind of level. You know, there were some a little smaller than that, but, these are small in the scheme of things for around this size, but, they're still real investments.
Sure, yeah. So if you can, Smoke, explain or compare the level of enthusiasm of cannabis investors, the level of enthusiasm that they have for that asset class vis-a-vis investors in other asset classes, whether it be real estate, energy, stocks, bonds. I don't know how much experience you have with other asset classes. You've obviously been a businessman for a while. But is there a difference you see in the level of enthusiasm? It's almost, I would compare it almost to possibly the piece, the computer world, where you look at the level of enthusiasm of Apple users versus PC users. It's cultish almost. And I don't know if that's the case, your experience with cannabis, but is there any more enthusiasm for cannabis than you've seen for other asset classes?
Yeah, I mean, look, I would compare it to, the excitement around the early days of the internet and .com world, where everyone knew something big was happening. No one knew exactly what it was going to look like. And there was a lot of excitement and a lot of investor appetite for it. But that was driven in large measure by a lot of venture capital backing. And that has been, relatively unavailable in this space, right? Now, that's changing pretty quickly. Like, some of these funds that started out a couple years ago were really tiny, but now they're all doing bigger rounds. And so they're becoming a more of a professional investment community around the space. But up until now, it was even the main funds that were investing in it were all pretty small. So if you had to raise a round like we raised, even if you got a bunch of those funds, none of them could do the round themselves, because our raise was bigger than most of the funds.
Interesting. Okay, now let's get to the lessons learned. What lessons did you learn that you could pass along to other entrepreneurs and fundraisers in general? We've got a lot of financial people out there that raise funds. And so other entrepreneurs who maybe are planning a roadshow of their own, particularly cannabis entrepreneurs perhaps, but really obviously the lessons are more general than that. So what do you think you came back with as lessons that you would pass along?
Yeah, so I mean, what I said a little earlier, I mean, a while back, that study of like what makes things the most successful or have made lots of companies successful, and timing is a huge factor. And but of course, not everybody at this same time is going to be successful. So what differentiated us, what differentiates any company, is do they have the right business idea model at the right moment in time, where there's wind at their back and wind at the sails, and do they have the team that can execute it? And that's not a new lesson learned for me. It's just something that's been reinforced with this. And then the other thing is kind of keeping it real. I mean, there's so much hyperbole out there about this space that in some ways talking calmly and just being, analytical about like the opportunity, wins confidence of investors, a lot more so than the hype, right? So, we all know it's exciting. It's a very growth-oriented space. I certainly, have articulated that, very, very clearly to a lot of people. But that being said, it's going to take a while. And part of our story was, it's a super growth thing, but the regulation comes in fits and starts. It's kind of a step function, you know, and we're a startup working with startup suppliers, with startup customers, with a startup government. I mean, we're teaching the regulators how to inspect our grows and how to look at things, because they don't have experienced people, which that makes this one really unique, you know. But again, it's about credibility and having a team of people who, you know, bring complementary skill sets and past experiences of success to the table, and then being able to articulate that well. And if you put all those together in a business that the timing's right, you're gonna get support and you'll get investors.
So our guest has been Smoke Wallen. He's an accomplished CEO, entrepreneur, regarded as a thought leader, 25 years of success in consumer products, alcohol, the alcohol beverage industry, in distribution, technology. So he's got broad interests, and obviously he's striking while the iron is hot when it comes to cannabis. And my understanding, Smoke, is that after you studied the legal medical cannabis industry, you recognize the convergence of legal cannabis and the alcohol beverage industry, and that really kind of pulled you into the whole cannabis space. You obviously see the opportunity there. Is anything I just said, is everything I said accurate? Is there anything that wasn't spot on there?
No, you're absolutely right. And you know, I spent, when I sold out of my last whiskey company I started, my wife turned to me and said, hey, before you do another liquor deal, we got to look at cannabis. And I didn't know anyone in it, and I didn't know much about it, and I wasn't really a participant in the sport in any large degree. So I was like, okay, well, I spent 6 months studying the industry, networking, finding out what was happening regulatory-wise, and then where the right opportunity was for me personally to get engaged and bring the experience I've had from another industry to this industry. And, you know, I took my time to do that. And, you know, I think that's the other thing, is I was also willing to pull the trigger. And, you know, today it doesn't seem that bold, but a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, when I pulled the trigger and jumped from a, you know, fairly well-known person in the alcohol beverage industry to this industry, I was the first kind of person like that to do that. Now, it didn't hurt that Constellation made their first investment in Canopy, mm-hmm. in October of 2017. You know, they invested $198 million, and I literally turned to my wife and said, okay, that's a New York Stock Exchange listed company. I've known the Sands brothers, you know, since, you know, I knew their dad, Marvin, and I've watched them grow their business. They just put $200 million into cannabis. What am I worried about? I'm jumping in. I'm going to do this myself. And that kind of got me over the hump of jumping into an industry that had, you know, the characteristics that this one has. And I haven't looked back, and I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, you know, that Constellation Brands investment was real validation for a lot of people. It just showed everybody not only the amount of confidence people were starting to have in cannabis as a business, but also just the financial commitment they were willing to make, which for Constellation Brands was, that's not a backbreaker, but it's still a lot of money. It's serious money. And they obviously feel that there's going to be a positive return on that. And Smoke, as you said earlier, you served as chairman and president of the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of America. So our audience understands you've been into a lot of fun stuff. So congratulations on the fundraise. I told our listeners earlier that with that name, Smoke Wallen, you remind me of a character in a Kinky Friedman novel. And if you haven't read Kinky Friedman, check them out. I would recommend the Mile High Club, and wouldn't be bad with a beer or maybe even a little product from Vertical, Smoke's company. So.
Yeah, great. I'll take you up on it. Sounds good. Hey, thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.